This is Phil Rowe.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Wow, listen to those drums, The Clash and Tommy Gunn on Cambridge 105 Radio. I'm going to be talking about that in just a moment. And the amazing drumming from the band, from one particular, Topper Heaton, who was the drummer of The Clash. An unpretentious record of straight English punk, that. It is time to introduce our guest this morning, who is with us, Tim Satchell. All the Peacemakers is the book. And it's a good, thick, heavy book. Good morning to you, Tim. Bring your microphone in a little closer to yourself. There we are. That's it. We can hear you a little better. Welcome back to Cambridge 105
Radio. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for asking me back. Well, it takes me back.
It does take us back because you and I last faced the studio together, on Sunday breakfast, a number of years ago now. And you've been working hard on this new book. When do you get time to do this? Because you're normally down on the train every morning, commuting to London.
Yeah, if I have a shed, the man has a shed, and I spend a lot of time in my shed, and I spend a lot of time in the British Library in London, who have this amazing collection of old Music Press, NME, Melody Maker sounds. I spend hours trawling through each year, each month, of about a couple of years worth in there. So that takes quite a lot of time, but it's a lovely place to be if you want to research a book.
Nice and quiet in there. You take your British Library card with you, or you can sign up on the day if nobody's ever been down there to queue. Get down there on the district line and off you go with your research. You sit there for hours. Is it Saturday morning for you to do that?
I used to go, because the part I go to is by King's Cross, so it was quite, because I commute into London every day, King's Cross Station, and then just walk a couple of blocks down, and then the British Library, the part that has the Music Press in there, is there.
So that's up
it was okay. Quite handy. So a few sort of later nights getting home or whatever, a few days off here and there. But lovely place. I hope that place stays forever because it's fantastic.
If you're a music lover like yourself, then you can pour through things. And you must be, every time you go, find new things about the band that you thought, wow, I never really knew that. But it's the passion that you have. So we'll take ourselves back to the time, 1978, when this album was released. The Clash, their second album. Punk music was settling down a little bit at that time. It never really, really went mainstream, but it was a case of, well, we got used to the Sex Pistols, we braced ourselves, bands like The Clash came along, and they were certainly being accepted. And this was a track I remember getting airplay on radio at that time. I would have been about 19 years, this is giving my age away now, 19 years old at the time, and remembering it getting played. And remember, the third album was the real cracking album that really broke them as a commercial band around the world, in America as well. But this second album, of which you've written a book, was trying to be American-centric as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was a kind of, if you look at it now, looking back, it's a kind of stepping stone between the first album, which you could say was kind of more or less sort of straight ahead punk rock, and then London Calling, which was like kind of, you know, let's just stick everything in the kitchen sink in an album and every genre. Beautiful
album.
Which
is the album that followed on.
Yeah, London Calling. So Give Enough Rope was this kind of stepping stone. There was some pressure from the record label and that they were signed to CBS, and they had the sister company or mother company in the States was Epic. There was quite a lot of pressure on them to actually produce an album that would sell in America. There was an attempt to, they brought in an American producer, Sandy Perlman, who was quite heavily involved with Blue Oyster Cult, and probably the only single you remember is Don't Fear the Reaper.
I was going to mention that one.
But so they brought him in and presented him to the band. The band sort of accepted, I think, him producing the album. There's a lot of controversy about whether that was the right thing to do, the wrong thing to do. Should they have said, no, we don't want him, we want to do something else. But the idea was that he would produce this sort of more polished, shall we say, American-friendly, AOR-friendly sound. And Maybe he did. But certainly the quality of the recording and is way, way ahead of the first album. Some people took offence to that. People wanted the band to produce the Clash first album for the second time. And the band, from all my reading and stuff, it's like they could have done that. They could have just done another version of the first album. But they actually wanted to take things a little further, and they actually didn't want to be kind of like fenced in. It was like this is all they do. This is the kind of thing they do.
And you're always going to get people say you've sold out. You've gone. It wasn't mainstream at all, though. The sound was still raw. I could see why. I mean, Americans are conservative with the small c sometimes, and when the mainstream sort of AOR music in America is very. You never really shake people up with the music, but the Clash were sure out to do that. I mean, how was it taken in the States?
The idea was that they would have some sort of sound that the American radio stations would play, and they'd get a bit of a profile in the States. I would say, I mean, that the album sales in the States were not, runaway success when Give Them Enough Rope was released. A lot of their reputation had been built on their first album, but actually import copies, UK import copies of that album that were selling quite strongly. And that's where people were picking up on the band. And that's the Give Them Enough Rope album actually came along, was released before the first album got an official release in the States. So They did a tour of the States early in 1979, sort of beginning of the year, to promote Give Them Enough Rope, and to in effect they also promoting the first album, which went down quite well. From all my reading, there's some great stuff out there. Some American guys have written books about it. I've read them all. but it was quite difficult getting them on the radio. They weren't sort of like Boston or Journey, which is what the kind of American ears were.
I can't imagine FM sort of mellow West Coast rock stations like K101 in San Francisco, stations like, which I used to listen to when I was out in working in the Bay Area in San Francisco. That, it would be more. Although it was way before Take That, the first thing that came in my head, but they would be playing that in American on the West Coast. I can't imagine the Clash getting back east. I can imagine Boston,
yes, yeah.
New York,
yeah,
kind of, because after all, Blondie started that way with more in punk before they headed mainstream. So I'd imagine the Clash, there must have been a few fans in New York.
They picked when they actually got to the States, they did pick the cities they played at very carefully. There's so much in the book about all this kind of stuff, but there was a promoter involved in the States, and he had a really good idea about how they should be presented and where they should be presented. So they didn't try and do a huge tour across the States. They hit like New York. They did Berkeley, whatever you want to call it there, but Boston around there, and California, a couple of places in California. So it was targeted, like attack, if you like. And that sort of paid off. The New York show that they did, there was a lot of kind of celebrities there, Robert De Niro and Andy Warhol, and Mick Jones's mother even turned up. She'd actually lived in America for a number of years, but that was like the foothold, if you like. And then later in the year they went back again, and they had a much, much bigger impact. But the album itself, I don't think it really was a runaway success in the States. They didn't do themselves any favours either, because at one of the shows that they did in the States, there was a whole load of Epic record label executives all flown in to do this kind of big meet and greet with the band, and have their photos taken and all this kind of stuff.
And they walked out.
And they just took umbrage, the Clash, and just walked straight out. And there was a huge row over that, and it was like a major kind of PR disaster for them, really. So they kind of didn't do themselves any favours in that respect. But I think the music spoke for itself. you know, the people, the fans, people heard it, you know, a lot of it maybe was word of mouth, but they just built up this fantastic following. And I guess they lost a lot of people support maybe from the UK, because it's like, oh, you sold out and you've gone to the States. But I totally get why they wanted to do that. They didn't want to be sort of like just another little UK band. They saw that there was a big old world out there, and definitely their horizons on Give 'Em Enough Rope had really widened. So the first album was very much about, you know, Tower Block, whatever, you know, Riot, this kind of stuff, which was what was going on around them at the time. But the second album, as you said, Phil, that, you know, by 78, the punk thing had kind of like leveled out to a degree, and there was a real dilemma about whether they should stay, you know, if you like punk rock, or whether they could like introduce a few more different elements into their music, which they actually did. And they, you know, they got a lot of criticism for that. Difficult. I at my age, I was a bit younger than you. I was like 17, I think, when the album came out. But I didn't really take much attention to all this kind of criticism and, oh, you know, they should do this and not that. And I mean, Joe Strummer used to say there was this thing called the punk rock police that kind of, you know, almost like dictated what you should and couldn't do. I got the album. It just blew me away. I mean, it's like you stick it on. There's a track on the first track on side one is called Safe European Home. There's our friend Topper Heaton just whacks the drum. One beat and this song.
How about Tommy Gunn? I mean, we came in with Tommy Gunn. I mean, the way that he cracks onto those drums, presumably is rimming the drum.
It's just, I mean, you know, it's just extraordinary. He was an incredible player.
It's like a machine gun.
Yeah, that's the, you know, the Tommy Gunn thing.
Tommy Gunn. I mean, you know, he's, I guess, just like that. Yes, yeah. Of course.
Amazing. I mean, they were, the Clash were, well, you know, I say they were lucky that Topper came along, because they'd been through a number of drummers, not really found any permanent drummer, and Topper had been playing lots of different styles of music, been playing in sort of covers bands, soul bands and stuff, and the fact that he joined and could just, if in a way, transform, you know, and open up all this kind of different music that they could play. I mean, I guess some people might think, oh, you know, they couldn't play and they only knew how to play like three chords or something. But actually, some of the stuff that goes on, Mick Jones, absolutely incredible. You know, arranger, like guitarist, I mean, incredible. Joe Strummer's lyrics, the combination of those two writers, just unbelievable.
But Paul Simonon was the bassist, and I suppose none of them were really the weak link in the chain, but we can say this about him, and bless him, actually, he had to do several retakes in the studio where each track they were doing, and they used to call the Human Drum Machine was the name for Topper.
Yeah.
His Topper was his nickname anyway, and his second nickname was the Human Drum Machine. He didn't mind at all. He just cracked away with the drums, had to do a retake because the bass went wrong. Poor old Paul Simonon and the band.
I mean, Sandy Perlman, the producer, just couldn't believe Topper. You know, he just said, like, I think he made, like, you know, three mistakes in hundreds of takes. So he was really, really impressed with Topper. And he did his parts on the recording, like, very quickly, went in and he did them and there was no nonsense. Paul Simonon was always the less strong musically, I guess, player. He was kind of forced to do retake after retake after retake with the bass parts, and it did really wear not just him but the whole band down, because they just didn't want to. They wanted to go. Joe in particular and Paul, I think, were like, had this philosophy of like, go in and bash it down, you know, just go in and do it, whereas Sandy Perlman wanted absolute perfection, and they did struggle with that a lot. Having said that, you know, Paul Simonon, they've just done this, I'm plugging ears, but they've just done this fantastic album, Good, Bad and the Queen, with Damon Albarn. Paul Simonon's playing on that is just fantastic. Sort of, yeah, it's kind of like almost like reggae, which is always his big thing. But you listen, I urge you, listen to that album and listen to the bass, because he's just, that is something else. Fantastic.
And you write in the book, Tim, that at one point Joe Strummer, the lead of the band, of course, The Clash, was hospitalised for a number of weeks having succumbed to a bout of hepatitis. And there was a punishing schedule of touring, of course, to promote those single releases, including Tommy Gunn. There are a couple of single releases from the album to build up a fan base for that second album. Lots of issues as well. They had their own, like bands always do, their own personal issues, drug use, alcohol, disagreements with their management, constant questions challenging their credibility. Are we good enough to do this? Can we really take on the world? The UK, we're talking about the US, of course, it was just as important over here. Touring over here as well, and I seem to think, you haven't got your little pink book with you today, Tim, that they played about 2 miles from here at the Cambridge Corn Exchange, and I went along to see them. I think it was in early 1979. We can't be sure of that. Listeners, 07919 070490. I should know if I saw a band like The Clash play Cambridge, and I'm pretty certain I did.
In the famous Clash pink book, which I suppose Clash fans will know about, that all the tours are listed in the venues, although I did find some mistakes in there. but certainly they've played the Corn Exchange. They would have played in 79 with for the London Calling, promoting London Calling era stuff. And I meant to look before I came out. They did two major tours in 1978, the Sort It Out tour to promote this album and the previous tour. So Cambridge would not have been missed that.
And with the book, you've tried to introduce some of the perhaps less well-known people who were behind the scenes while the band were producing this album as well.
Yeah, I kind of took it on. My background really is, so I kind of worked, I was really keen on music. I worked in a record shop when I was younger, and I kind of followed that interest. I did different things, and I worked kind of, but it's always like kind of backroom music industry stuff. So it's kind of not the glamorous stuff, the stuff like, you know, packing boxes in warehouses, stock control, all this kind of stuff. They were less glamorous jobs that I was involved with. But you realise how important all those other people are, and not necessarily people stacking boxes, but the other people that are behind the scenes. So there was so many people involved around that time in that album. They were making a film at the same time, a film was being made, a sort of film made about them. So there was all this stuff going on in the background. So there was these guys that were like kind of two guys that just started doing this kind of almost like a documentary, but not quite. There's a lot of people behind the scenes. These American guys are producers and these promoters, and just I really like the fact that there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, and these people don't get a lot of credit for what they do, but they're just as important as the actual four performers or whatever. So I think that's kind of more it's more interesting for me. I hope people find some interest in that too.
Maybe a good book for Christmas for someone.
Yeah,
is it going to be out in time for that? And then you've been sort of hurrying.
It's been difficult. I had all this in place ready for the 40th anniversary of the album, and I was hoping to have it out, available for sale around that time. There's been a few problems getting the text in a way that the printer can actually print the book. So I'm hoping I can get it in before the end of the year. If not, I was going to say to people, you've always got your book tokens from WX Smith to buy a book with, but of course people don't get book tokens anymore. But if it isn't available, it's going to be the end of this year at the very earliest. If not, sort of January. I have a Facebook page. If you search for All the Peacemakers, that will be updated with release information, anything that I that's going on to promote it. That's really it. I haven't got a definite date, I'm afraid. I have got a website, which is a bit of a mouthful.
Go for it.
Okay, so it's timss08.wixsite, that's wixsite.com/ All-the-peacemakers. That is a bit of a mouthful, so it's probably easier if you can find it on Facebook.
I've just done a little search for you anyway and come up with some stuff anyway. So as listeners, might be easier because you might be driving at the moment. So All the Peacemakers is what you're thinking of. Combat Ready was the first book from Tim as well. So have a look online. Tim Satchwell is the author. Early next year then, Tim?
Yeah,
will it be available online?
Yes. Yeah, online, and I will have it in some, I'm afraid. I did try selling it in Cambridge. I sold a couple, but I'm going to probably try and do a special edition for some two shops in London, Sister Ray and one called All Ages. They were fantastic. They really got behind me and sold quite a lot of copies. So I might do a special version just for the shops, and then the other one will be online.
And then you'll be going away for a nice rest, I'd imagine. But thinking about perhaps doing something on the big album that everybody pretty much has heard of, London Calling.
Well, there's already a fantastic book that's been done on London Calling. A guy called Marcus Gray. He did the first book on the Clash completely, the whole kind of career, which I ever read, which was just fantastic. And then he did another one about London Calling, and I would find it hard, I think, to come close to bettering that. I mean, it's a different approach he took, but his level of research was quite extraordinary.
I think yours is not half bad either, Tim Satchrell. Thank you very much for joining us this morning on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Could I just say, sorry, there's an online book, a Kindle book, that a good friend of mine who helped me out an awful lot, a guy called Anthony Davey, who wrote his own book on Joe Strummer, or took a couple of books. He did this, he's done this book, which is called This Is Joe Public Speaking, and it's all stories from Clash fans from around the world, and it's only online. It's only on like a Kindle book. You have to download it, but all the proceeds go to Great Ormond Street Hospital, Children's Hospital. Fantastic book. I'm just not all read it all myself, but it's really interesting stories from people actually there, and you know, who love the band. That's worth a read, if it isn't digitally anyway. And there's the reason he did that was because there was a BBC. He was approached by the BBC to get some people involved to do these podcast series about the Clash. So that's coming next year, I think, but certainly the book you can get online now. It's a download. Thank you very much for the plug there.
Thank you very much. You did it. You did it well. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.